Willow Valley Communities recognizes the need for a national conversation about the Vietnam War and is proud to support the efforts to preserve the memories of those who lived through it. More information is available at willowvalleycommunities.org. The law firm of Saul Ewing, Arnstein and Lehr, who are proud to partner with WITF in preserving our history to enable future generations to explore the past, understand the present, and create the future. Saul Ewing is online at saul.com.
Smart Talk is supported by Capital Blue Cross, providing health care coverage accepted by doctors and specialists in all 50 states. More information is available at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, live fearless. Smart Talk is also supported by Pinnacle Health Spine Institute, offering a complete range of services to diagnose and treat your spine condition. More information is available at pinnaclehealth.org/spine.
We're talking about the Harrisburg Seven and the New Catholic Left. That's the book written by William O'Rourke, our guest during this portion of the program. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call at 1-800-729-7532 or send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that is 1-800-729-7532. We have a phone call here from Dave in Lemoyne. Dave, you're on the air.
Hi. Am I there?
Yes. Yes, you are.
Okay. I had a couple of anecdotes. I was there, and what hasn't been mentioned was that there were some very nice peaceful demonstrations that took place during that. I think it was in took place in Easter week. And the week leading up to Easter, and there were some concerts of people like Peter Yarrow performed in the Augsburg Lutheran Church, a wonderful concert, and Joan Baez was there, and that was the thing, of course, that stood out in my mind because I didn't attend the trials, but and you're right about, you know, they chose Harrisburg as a venue because it was conservative, because the local people stood along the sides of the road and jeered the marchers, you know, and what we, I think it started out in the up at Reservoir Park, and they marched across the bridge to the Capitol, and there was even a bona fide miracle that took place. A guy from somewhere out in the Northwest, because people came from far away as Washington State, and the guy had a German Shepherd dog with him, and the dog jumped up on the edge of the bridge for no apparent reason, and jumped off the bridge, landing about 60 feet below on Cameron Street, and a policeman rode up to the hysterical owner of the dog with his motorcycle, and quickly ran down to the street. And they found the dog, and the dog was virtually unharmed. It was amazing. Mm-hmm. But, I just wanted to, yeah.
Dave, thanks for passing that along. And Mr. O'Rourke, that does bring up a point, and you describe this in your book about the demonstrations. And you also had mentioned that Harrisburg became the center of attention during that period.
Right. It certainly did. He was speaking, the caller, Easter week. Fell at the same time with jury deliberations, and the jury was out. It was the longest, they were out for almost a week, and that was the longest period any federal jury had ever been out. And one can only think it was, since it was a hung jury of 10 to 2 for acquittal, that the 10 were trying to convince the 2 to change their votes. But nonetheless, yes, during the entire trial, there was the Harrisburg Defense Committee wanted to play up the peaceful side of things. So indeed, there were concerts, there were events almost every night. None at Catholic churches, that was the oddity. The Catholic bishops then as now were mainly conservative, and they didn't want to show any overt help to the Catholic defendants in this trial. But so Protestant churches opened the doors, and there were many talks, many concerts, many peaceful rallies. But oddly, at the very end, the more active vein of the East Coast conspiracy to save lives where these people were affiliated with, went to the AMC plant where they make bomb casings outside of Harrisburg and vandalized bomb casings. Also during that period, they vandalized them by, you know, they're threaded at the top, these 500-pound bombs. And they, with chisels, they vandalized the threads. That didn't get much publicity because it happened right at the end of the trial. But so there was still this tension that was going on between the peaceful anti-war movement and the not-so-peaceful anti-war movement.
Let's go to Tom in Harrisburg. Tom, you're on the air.
Thank you very much for the show. I was a student at Bucknell, thanks to my parents' generosity, and I met Lloyd Douglas in the fall of 1970. And then lo and behold, we find out later that he is the main witness against the so-called conspiracy. It was a moment that I'll never forget, and it really affected me, but it affected Bucknell faculty and upperclassmen even more so, because they had really committed to this idea of giving prisoners an education, and they were burned. They were burned badly. They, in fact, felt as if they were on trial. And one of the remarkable footnotes to this story is that one of the witnesses the government subpoenaed refused to testify. She was a Bucknell librarian, Zoya Horn. She freely gave of her advice to Mr. Douglas, the prisoner witness, and she refused to testify and was spent 3 weeks in jail, the first time an American librarian was ever jailed for contempt of court. So thank you, Mr. O'Rourke. Thank you for the show. It's a very important story for our country to know about.
Thank you very much for your call. And you write about that, don't you, William?
Yes, I do. I met Zoya Horn. She's one of the heroes, at least in my eyes, for the same reason the caller pointed out, you know, that she was a librarian going to jail because she wasn't going to reveal, you know, the privacy of the library. Yes, it was a time to see, in some ways, the best and worst of things. In some odd way, the point in history we are now, and that'll be the lens that Ken Burns' film is going to be seen through, is in some ways a rebuke, meaning back then in 72, even though I was a cynical young man, I still thought things were headed in the right direction. And here we found ourselves in 2017 with a baby boomer president who was never in the street protesting. And it seems to be a rebuke to all of his generation who did, you know, have moral conflicts, who did have pride and love for their country and wanted it to do better and to be better. And now the representative of that generation who's sitting in the Oval Office is nothing of the people who gave their heart and souls, you know, to all the turmoil that was surrounding them back in 72.
Or served in the military. William O'Rourke is author of The Harrisburg Seven and the New Catholic Left. I want to thank you very much for being with us today.
Well, I'm happy to have done it. Take care, Scott.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. The Vietnam War WITF Stories is supported locally by Willow Valley Communities and the Harrisburg Law Office of Saul Ewing, LLP. We are in the midst of WITF's fall fundraising campaign, and I'm joined by WITF's multimedia news director, Tim Lambert. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Scott. Great to be here.
As a student of history,
yes.
As you are,
yes.
So am I. this, you know, talking about Vietnam and very much looking forward to Ken Burns' The Vietnam War documentary starting this Sunday. I mean, these are fascinating stories. And Harrisburg, just heard, 1972, kind of like the center of the universe when it came to protesting the Vietnam War.
Yeah, and it's been great. It's part of what we do. We tell stories, and add context to those stories, historical context in this case. WYTF has been doing preview screenings of Ken Burns, the Vietnam War, and in various locations, and just hearing the stories of veterans, the people who lived through that era. I was very, very, very young when the Vietnam War came to an end, but we're producing stories talking to veterans. I was on an honor bus trip in April and had a chance to talk to veterans at the wall of names of the Vietnam veterans who lost their lives. And so we're going to have a story about that this week. One of the gentlemen there talked about how the first person he saw die in Vietnam, he wanted to find his name and how he wanted to reach out to the family, and he actually did. So those are the stories that you come to expect each and every day from WYTF. And the point of this conversation is to ask you to make a contribution and support those efforts. Support what it takes to tell those stories to you each and every day. Go to WYTF.org or call 1-800-233-9483 to make a contribution of $5 a month, of $10 a month, of $20 a month. And I think, Scott, that there is still a match going on for contributions of $100 or more right now. Those will be matched dollar for dollar. Make that contribution at WYTF.org.
You know, Tim, you know, and you out there know as well, because whether you consciously think about it, but maybe from time to time you do, but there are certain topics that are favorites amongst WITF listeners, and history is one of them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, many of the things that we deal with today, many of the issues we deal with today are not new. We've dealt with them before, and events that happened, say in Vietnam or during that era 40 some odd years ago, still have an impact today. And as you mentioned, that's what we're all about, a context, having civil conversation, but making the connection between those dots, between Vietnam and what's happening today.
Yeah, what was interesting is as we've been having this conversation about Vietnam, there was some debate on Twitter, not always the greatest place to go for debate, but there was a debate about, oh, the country right now, presently, is in so much turmoil. It's never been anything like this. So many challenges. And everyone who lived through the Vietnam era saying, wait a minute, you don't know what turmoil was until you lived through what this country went through in Vietnam. So it's interesting to have that context to let you know that this has happened before in this country. We've seen much worse than what's going on right now. So that's the context, though, we try to provide to you each and every day. And we hope that that's what you appreciate. You want to get outside your bubble. You want to hear different perspectives. You want to hear stories that you might not be interested in, but all of a sudden you find yourself interested when you hear them. Make that contribution and support WITF. Support Smart Talk with that $5 a month contribution, $10 a month contribution. Again, $100 contribution for the year will be matched dollar for dollar at WITF.org or 1-800-233-9483.
Tim, thank you very much, and we'll be talking to you again in a few minutes.
You got it.
We Gotta Get Out of This Place. The Soundtrack of the Vietnam War is a book that examines the part that music played for those who fought in Vietnam. It may not be what you think. Over the years, music that accompanied any conversation about Vietnam or film or video focused on the anger, the chaos, and protest of the war, not what the fighting men and women listened to or what impact that music had on them. Our guest is Doug Bradley, one of the co-authors of We Gotta Get Out of This Place, the Soundtrack of the Vietnam War. Mr. Bradley, welcome to the program.
Thanks. It's great to be with you.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532, or send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. And I just want to circle back for just a moment, something I said in my introduction. This is kind of the song that many people think of when they think about Vietnam 45 years later. Well, Mr. Bradley, as I mentioned, so often when you hear about music from the Vietnam era, It was music like Edwin Starr's War. But especially early on, up until 67, 68, that's not what the soldiers were listening to in Vietnam, was it?
No, it wasn't. And, this is part of this mythology that's been created around the war and around the time. I thought you guys alluded to it well when people were saying, we never had a more difficult time. That time was difficult and challenging across a variety of sectors and factors. And I think, we've tried to make it a little easier or simpler than it was. It wasn't black and white. It wasn't just hawk and dove. I mean, Edwin Starr's song comes out in 70, and it was one of the few Motown songs that made any kind of statement about the war. Berry Gordy and Motown tried to play it safe. And I heard that song when I was in the Army. I heard it in Vietnam, and it was sort of like, okay, nice beat, easy to dance to. I'll give it an 85. But it's not, we're in the war. We understand everything that's at stake and at risk. So we don't need somebody like Edwin Starr sort of shouting at us. It was more likely that we found over the course of 12 years of conversations with men and women who served in Vietnam that Leaving on a Jet Plane or Detroit City by Bobby Bear, sitting in the dock of the bay, Sloop John B. with that great line, "I Want to Go Home." Those are the songs that the men and women told us sort of pulled at their heartstrings, maybe kept them connected to their loved ones at home and helped them to get through the war.
So let's talk about that, because you write in the book that that was one of the main factors when the soldiers and the Marines, the sailors who were fighting in Vietnam, one of the main factors to them was not the war, the politics of the war, people dying around them, that kind of thing. It was getting home. They were homesick. They wanted to go home, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think any soldier who gets deployed overseas, that connection to family, to where you're safe, where you feel that you're with the context and the environment you want to be in. It happens now too. But I think then, given the stress, the turmoil, plus we had designated tours. We didn't go over as units as happened in the recent wars. We didn't go over with our neighbors and our friends and our buddies. We went pretty much one at a time, 13 months for Marines, 12 months for Army. You did your tour, you rotated into a unit, you rotated out. And frankly, in a lot of cases, it was the music that enabled us to sort of stay close, connected. If you remember that time, radio was our internet. We all listened to the same music, whether you stayed or served, you protested or you participated. We all had the same soundtrack. But, of course, in Vietnam, that soundtrack and that song can have a totally different meaning depending on where you were and what you were doing.
And it's so good to hear someone who's made their living in radio that, radio has had such an impact on people before there were other forms of, listening, before, the internet, before CDs and all mm-hmm. that radio was that tie to going home. From what you describe in the book, it seems to be, and I don't know if I'm putting this accurately or not, but a real change between, like, say 1967 and 68. Let's talk about pre-68. What were the people in Vietnam, what were they listening to then?
Well, they were listening to pretty much the same stuff that we were listening to back home. Armed Forces Vietnam Network, AFVN, they did an incredible job of trying to, mirror what we were listening to at home. The Army and the military decided early on that one of the ways to keep the troops' morale up and realize, you're out in the field and you're in those kind of kill or be killed situations, silence is important. You might have a song running around in your head, but you're not listening to music like guys like me who are in the rear supporting the troops in the field were doing. But, for the troops themselves, they decided they were going to give us access to as much music as possible. So Armed Forces Vietnam Radio out of Saigon had transmitters around the country. They used to say from the Delta to the DMZ, 24/7. Music. We had live bands, Filipino, Korean, Vietnamese bands. They couldn't speak a word English, but they could cover Janis Joplin and James Brown. James Brown went to Vietnam. Johnny Cash went to Vietnam. Nancy Sinatra. Point being, they understood that the threat of this generation, the generation that was born and weaned on rock and roll, was that music. and they gave us the music as in many ways as they could. You know, but early on, when you talk about, in our book, we talk about JFK, John Kennedy's war, LBJ, Lyndon Johnson's war, and then Richard Nixon's war. They really do, things shape and evolve differently, and the music is a great touch point for that. Early on, the early advisors, pre-Gulf of Tonkin, early in the war, after 64, 65, we were going to be liberators. This was going to be quick. We were going to be in and out. You know, these are some career soldiers coming out of even World War II, but Korea. They're listening to Tony Bennett. They're listening to Pat Boone. You know, it's a different soundtrack. But then as you get deeper into the war and, you know, things start to change both here and there, you start to hear something different. You know, and the Beach Boys, who were singing Fun, 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 are now singing Good Vibrations. James Brown, you know, who was singing I Feel Good, is now saying, Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud. So you started to have that change. And as you said it, I thought very well, 68, everybody thinks of the Tet Offensive. Walter Cronkite, the great news anchor, going on TV saying, you know, I thought we were winning this war. Now we're not. You know, President Johnson said, if I've lost Walter Cronkite, I've lost the nation. But also for black troops, what happened at the time, Martin Luther King was assassinated. Bobby Kennedy was assassinated. We talked to black guys who said, you know what, if you can't protect my leader at home, why am I over here, you know, shooting this guy? I don't even know what this is about. Definitely attitude changed, musically changed, everything changed in 68.
And the music, I mean, I think anyone who listened to the radio at that time, whether we were in Vietnam or stateside, you could see that there was a real difference in the music. It was edgier. It was angrier. There was more focus on protest and on war and what was happening in the country at the time. So after 68, and we'll point to the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King for the African-American soldiers, what were some of their favorite songs, some of the favorite music to listen to at that time?
Well, we have a wonderful, wonderful anecdote by a guy in the book who said to us, very frankly, that when he heard, and this was not, the Army was worried about potential mutiny. I mean, we had challenging race relations going on in this country. We still do, but at the time, it was, the fight for civil rights and equal rights was intense. And imagine what that's like in the Army, which is more of a microcosm. Overseas in a war zone, everybody's got guns. this is a very volatile situation. We talked to a lot of black soldiers who did not hear this reported in Armed Forces Radio because they wanted to keep it quiet until they could let the commanders know that this was coming down and they were going to have their troops under control. They heard it from Hanoi Hannah, who was the equivalent of Tokyo Rose from World War II. Hanoi Hannah told a lot of our troops that Dr. King had been killed. And one of the guys we talked to said, when I got the news, I wanted to go out and shoot the first white guy I saw. I was so angry. And then he said he went back to his hooch. He had a little cassette deck, hooch was, your living, your barracks. It was pretty Spartan. But he had electricity, he had a cassette deck. And he listened to Aretha Franklin's Lady Soul album. And the song that spoke to him was Chain of Fools. And he listened to that song. And sure, it's about Aretha talking about a woman who's being scorned, and she's going to take care of this guy. She's going to break up with him, like she said, in Respect. But it's also a talk. It's about Chain of Fools. It's about breaking the chains of slavery. But this guy's listened to it there, and he says, it's breaking the chain of command. I'm not following these orders anymore because I'm done with this.
Mm. Talk more about it in just a moment.
Chain, chain, chain.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Regional, I'm Scott Lamar. Regional, I'm...
Willow Valley Communities recognizes the need for a national conversation about the Vietnam War and is proud to support the efforts to preserve the memories of those who lived through it. More information is available at willowvalleycommunities.org. The law firm of Saul Ewing, Arnstein, and Lehr, who are proud to partner with WITF in preserving our history to enable future generations to explore the past, understand the present, and create the future. Saul Ewing is online at saul.com.